As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
You're listening to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today, Arsenal's fading title hopes are basically over after a humbling defeat at home to Brighton. But we'll talk about Roberto De Zerbi's side and their brilliant season, how far they could go if they get into Europe. We'll also discuss what has cost Arsenal the title. Leeds United got a vital point against Newcastle at home. We'll ask what Big Sam has done to change this team. A nightmare for Bamford and Junior Firpo. Can Leeds get themselves out of it? Aston Villa put in another good performance to come past Spurs, who now can't make the Champions League. What next for the side with Ryan Mason in charge? And could Unai Emery be on his way back to the Europa League and to another title in the competition? We'll talk about a vital point for Nottingham Forest at Chelsea and how Frank Lampard's changed his tune a little bit, and of course reflect on Southampton's relegation from the Premier League after an 11-year stay. This is The Game. Hello, welcome back to The Game Podcast. I'm Hugh Wizencroft alongside Alison Rudd. Tom Roddy is here, Gregor Robertson too. And we have to begin with disappointment for Arsenal. Of course we do. It was brilliant from Brighton, really, at the Emirates Stadium to win 3-0. But what were fading title hopes are now completely over, I think. Not mathematically done, but you can't see any other outcome than Manchester City going to a fifth Premier League title in six seasons. Of course, City had a 3-0 victory over Everton at the weekend. That meant Arsenal needed to respond, but in front of their own fans, they just couldn't do it. In fact, their second half performance left a bitter taste in the mouth, as we saw in the thousands of departing Arsenal fans before full time. City will win the Premier League title next Sunday in front of their own fans if they can beat Chelsea at home. That's even if Arsenal beat Nottingham Forest on Saturday. City will be confirmed without playing if the Gunners lose at Forest. So next week, I think we are going to probably be discussing how City won the title. So today, I think our first topic is going to be how Arsenal lost it, to be perfectly honest. Two wins in their last seven Premier League matches may, I think, add up to a collapse. But I think a lot of the talk is about how proud Arsenal fans are. We've had a brilliant season, etc., etc. And I wonder how much the rhetoric of Arsenal throwing the title away needs to be given some credence as well. I think we'll do the overarching before we do the 90 minutes. Where do you think Arsenal lost the title?
Lack of depth, lack of experience of winning a title. They might just have started to believe the hype about them, which I think the fact that they didn't initially was their big plus point. I don't think at the start of the season anyone thought this is going to be a two-horse race between City and Arsenal, and they milked the slight underdog bit to that narrative and did that whole as a unit we can be greater than the sum of our parts because we've gone through bad times, we've had disappointments, they've stuck with the manager, I'm very grateful to be here, says Mikel, and they pull together and give it their all. So it's partly giving, when you do that you probably give too much in spurts rather than pace yourself through the season, which is what I mean by knowing how to win a title, which is that you don't just give it everything and then find yourselves petering out. Actually, I think they were lucky to stay in the race as long as they did because they were fortunate they didn't have too many injuries And there was a period, I think, where it was sort of spooky how few injuries they had, given the lack of depth in the squad. So this is not surprising to anybody that it is finishing with a slight whimper. They weren't equipped really to match City at all. And they ought to feel fantastic about how most of the season has gone. I'm absolutely appalled that so many fans left early. I mean, that's right back to the, 12 months ago, 18 months ago, when the fans were actively part of a defeat because their lack of backing for them. I mean, it's not over yet. Imagine, I don't know, there's a 0.5% chance that if every fan had stayed put and yelled their support and treated that defeat like a victory, it might have caused a wobble over in Manchester. I don't know. People are going to say they bottled it because of that more than what's happened on the pitch. It's not a question of bottling it. It's just they were completely outclassed by a team that I think is overall run better than them.
All right, let's give Brighton then some props, shall we? Because I think they were brilliant. And I'm going to come back to Arsenal in a little bit more depth in a moment. But as we're on it, outclassed, is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard to say anything more about how incredible this Brighton team is, because they're so, so brave. I think that's what it all comes down to. The way we've spoken about the way they play and their tactics and, inviting the press and I've the rotations. Caicedo now is as a right back moving into midfield. It's been Pascal Gross in the past. Always trying to get overloads, at the top end of the pitch. Basically not playing with a centre forward. They drop in to be like two number 10s and the wingers play forward higher up pitch. It's fascinating to watch all of it, but it comes down to bravery and energy and kind of unity as well. De Zerbi's the real deal. What he's done to that team, there's always been this conversation about, he's taken them on from when Graham Potter was the head coach. He's transformed them. He's not just taken them on. He's they're a completely different team. They play with much more attacking intent and bravery. And as you say, they outclassed them. A good stat in Bill Edgar's column today that in Brighton's last 18 matches against the Big Six, they scored 12 more goals than their opponents. And obviously some of that will take in Potter's time as well. But
haven't they scored more goals away than Chelsea have scored in
all
total?
Season? Yeah. That's another one of Bill's nuggets. Yeah, I enjoy Bill's column in the morning on Monday. But they're the real deal. And the whole conversation now is about them getting picked off in the summer. But what if they don't? What if they hold on to those players and add a few more as intelligently as they have in the past? What could they do from here?
They're not a silly football club though, because they know their recruitment's so good. If someone comes in and offers them £90 million for a player they paid 15 for, they're like, all right then, we'll go and spend 15 on the next Caicedo or whoever it might be.
They don't need to though. They don't need to now.
I know they don't need to, but like I say, they're not a silly
football
club.
No, they're not. They will,
if someone offers them five, six times what they paid for a player, they'll take it.
Maybe, but I also think they're wary of kind of running out of luck in terms of constantly selling off players. But Arsenal were one of the worst possible teams that Arsenal could have played yesterday, because in the most important game for them, they were up against not only a brilliant team, but also a motivated team. You saw De Zerbi's celebrations with the knee slide. Because they're going for Europe, because they have the motivation of that. And I think when you actually take into account, you just said, Gregor, about how De Zerbi coming in and transforming them, when you actually take into account what has happened this season, losing the coaching staff, losing Trossard, not just the manager, losing the whole coaching staff, losing Trossard, losing players last summer. I think it's up there with one of the best seasons for a club in the Premier League history. I mean, obviously nothing really surpasses Leicester, but they didn't really get derailed, whereas what happened in September to Brighton could have totally tripped them up, and it hasn't. They've just gone from strength to strength.
They're the team of the season. Mm. They're not going to win the title, but they're the team of the season because of all that you've just said, plus the fact they're the team you'll pay money to watch. Mm. I'd pay quite a lot of money to watch a lot of Brighton, whereas I wouldn't pay any money at all to watch the predictability of Manchester City. Brilliant though they are.
It's funny. Hold on.
No, I mean, I kind of understand what Alison's saying, because I was thinking of this. Like I said it the other week, that I think they're the best team to watch in the Premier League. And then you think, you know, Liverpool at their peak are a joy to watch and thrilling to watch. Manchester City the same. But there is something about the fact that they are not one of the big established clubs, and
there's more wonderment when it comes to Brighton. You're not as stunned by seeing Liverpool and Manchester City do great things.
But it's also about the way they do it. It's like, you often think, you know, there's different ways of playing, different ways of trying to take on the best teams. But this is fundamentally trying to kind of beat them at their own game almost in terms of dominating play is always going to be the best way, because like when you're hitting these sort of heights, Arsenal like didn't know what to do. They had no comeback. They had no way of kind of dealing with their energy and their bravery. I keep coming back to that word, like even from the goalkeeper. Like you saw that pass just evaded Xhaka, and then they were on the attack. And I keep going back to when I watched them against Brentford the other week, and Ivan Toney was like playing cat and mouse with Levi Colwill on, like in the centre circle, and they were baiting them to say, come on.
Yeah.
And I just remember sitting there thinking, what am I watching here? Yeah. Like, I used to play as a defender, and like if somebody asked me to do that, I would have laughed in their face. Like this feels like a different, James Gearbrand wrote about this too. It feels like a kind of counterpoint to pressing football, which is like the dominant force in European football. It has been for a good decade now. It feels like it could be a counterpoint to it, and they're like almost leading the way. They're doing it more sort of jarringly than anyone else I've seen.
It's totally an aside, but it will be interesting to see if they do, and they probably will lose at least one player this summer. It'll be interesting to see how they get on, because Bissouma went, Cucurella went, neither of them have got near the expectation, near the levels they were playing at Brighton. So is it the player in the system, or is it the individual talent? It feels like it's more the system and the culture within the
Trossard
club.
Trossard played well initially for Arsenal, although he didn't look great yesterday.
No, it's a good point, yeah.
Well, they got robbed as well for the third goal.
Yeah. I think, I don't know, I think there is something to the player within the system, to be honest. Some players, when they arrived at Brighton, you kind of thought, why have they signed this player? And they have improved. So it is a system that a player going into, we've seen very good results as well. So I thought they were absolutely great, but I kind of wanted to ask you guys if you think they'll be in Europe, because you watch a game like that, you think, okay, they're definitely going to be in the top seven. I think they will be in the top seven. I'd love to see them in the Europa League top six finish, but they've got tough games from here on out. As good as they played against Arsenal, they go away to Newcastle on Thursday. It's a tough game. Okay, they're at home to Southampton. You imagine they'll win that game, but then it's Manchester City at home, and it's Villa away on the final day. Of course, Villa, you know, in front of their own fans, might be needing to win that game to get into Europe. Makes it a very, very tricky game, even though you'd say Brighton are probably the better team. They're playing as well as anyone at the moment, really, Villa as well. So,
but Brighton play better when they're playing tricky games, don't they? I mean, Everton, they get thrashed by Everton, and that would be the one you'd say, well, that's 3 points in the bag as they on their quest towards European qualification. So they'll probably win all the ones that are supposed to be tricky.
City could have won the league by then too.
So you're saying 100%?
No, of course 100%. You can't say 100% because it's a bonkers season. But I don't think the fact those games are difficult on paper mean anything to Brighton.
It's tough. It's tough for Brighton. If they play as well as they played yesterday, they're not going to have an issue, to be perfectly honest. But I do look at those fixtures and wish they were a little bit easier. We'll see where Roberto De Zerbi can take them. And I enjoyed the celebration as well. Just kind of underlined, we've come here and
I'm
not respecting you guys. And, you know, he has given Brighton a little bit more ego, which I kind of like.
Yeah, that's exactly. He's got a bit of edge, a bit of devilment. Like you might kind of stray over the line actually if he has already. Mm, you know, mm. He's served a ban, touchline ban. But that feels different too to what came before. So, you know, he's added that kind of, and a bit of belief. He keeps saying it. Like he said it when everyone's been really kind of bashful and saying, well, Europe maybe, you know, even Emery took him ages to acknowledge that they're in the race for Europe. He's been saying it for months. Mm. No, this is what we want.
Oh, he's a fantastic, I mean, you know, some managers are barely predictable what they're going to say in the post-match press conference, but he's sarcastic.
Yeah.
He's rude. He's passionate. He's emotional. You know, he likes a difficult question. He likes a joke. He's fantastic.
Mm. And we're talking about the idea that they could lose players. They could lose Roberto De Zerbi in the summer because we know he's got a lot of high-profile suitors.
Well, that Spurs vacancy does make you wonder. That the temptation to go for him will be so high.
He wouldn't get on with Daniel Levy.
No. You see it in the way he talks, don't you? But he's got such an aura about him. He's the total opposite to Graham Potter, which is fascinating the way that it has seamlessly transitioned at Brighton. But I can see him getting a top six job easily, and I think you can see the ambition within him as well. Can't see it lasting too long at Brighton. I hope it does. I hope he stays there into next season.
One more season
would be great. One more season with all of them and a couple of additions. Yeah, who knows?
It's great for us. It's great.
Seriously, they're great.
No, but it's great for us and it's great for some kind of sports documentary or Hollywood movie. But ultimately, these managers, you know, they're hot for a minute and then they start to lose a few games and suddenly they're not as good as we thought they are. And you know, the, I don't know, Inter Milan's of this world or Barcelona's or whoever might be interested in him suddenly aren't there knocking down your door anymore. And managers are a bit savvy these days. So it'll be a big decision to stay at Brighton, depending on who wants to acquire his services. But Brighton fans hoping that he will be here to stay. Question is, are Arsenal here to stay? Because I wanted to go back to that point I made earlier on about...
Ooh, he's gone for the big collapse. He's gone for nuclear option here. They're not just not won the title. Hugh is suggesting they're going to spiral out of control and maybe get relegated.
I'm not saying that. I said, are they here to stay in terms of challenging for the title? That's my question.
That's less interesting.
Yeah. because I think a lot of Arsenal fans have reflected on it with a lot of positivity. And they're getting very angry at anyone that would say, maybe not that they bottled it or they collapsed, because I can understand why they'd be angry with that, but saying, and I'm one of these people, that they may have missed an opportunity that won't come round again for quite some time. And I think they're all kind of sitting here saying, no, we'll be challenging for the title again next season.
Are these the fans that left early or the ones that stayed?
I'm not sure. It's all on social media. But
the real fans.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I think the idea that they... I think they've missed an opportunity here, and I find it hard to be harsh on them for that because they've definitely exceeded all of my expectations. But the only argument is, why would I say that the likes of Chelsea or Liverpool will be stronger or Manchester United will be stronger as an assumption, but I'm not assuming that Arsenal will be stronger, and therefore if they're stronger and get more points than they got this year, that they will be, of course, once again in a title race. So I'm making assumptions about worse teams than Arsenal. But I think ultimately it doesn't come down to the players on the pitch, my viewpoint. It comes down to the kind of investment that goes into the other clubs. So I find it difficult to think that, you know, if Liverpool do sort out their midfield, they won't be a very, very strong team. That if Pochettino can streamline his squad, that Chelsea won't be as strong. There's still good players there, that they won't be a stronger team. Manchester United, I don't know who the owner will be. You know, there might be huge investment. Whether that will make them a lot stronger, I don't know. But you imagine if Harry Kane's up front for Manchester United, they will be a stronger team. And although it's worked well for Arsenal, shrewd recruitment, young players, improving players, got the contract sorted that they need to be sorted, the manager clearly looks a great, great talent. I'm not saying that Arsenal won't be a top four team. I'm not saying that they won't win cups or be a very strong team. But I can't see them overhauling Manchester City. But if someone said to me, who do you think will be the main title challengers to City next season? I don't think I would say Arsenal, I'd say Liverpool.
I think it depends on, like you said, on the transfer window. If Harry Kane goes to Man United, I could definitely see them being the biggest contender for Man City. But your first question, Hugh, was about why there has been this drop of form from Arsenal, and Alisson was absolutely right. It's the lack of depth, and it has led to almost a burnout, essentially, because they've had 33 changes to their starting 11. And that is the least of any team in the Premier League. The next, I think, is 48 changes. And so there is a huge reliance on a small number of players at Arsenal. They haven't had the other options to turn to. That's why they enter the market in January with Jorginho and Trossard, and it helped. It really did help. But I think they're going to need to do a bit more business than just Declan Rice this summer to remain at the levels that they are at. And also, seeing the situation at the moment, seeing the drop in form and that sense of a burnout, it worries me slightly that they could end up in a similar situation to Liverpool this year, because I think Liverpool were more prepared. They had more tools to go up against City, and Arsenal have overachieved massively. And I don't know whether they can maintain it next season without more investment than just Declan Rice.
I don't think they've overachieved.
Do you not?
No. I think...
Arsenal?
No.
So you expected this before the season, did you?
No, but now they're dropping away. They've got 12 points more than last season. That's four wins. It's like, it's a jump, but it's not the jump that we thought was going to be. So, like, you know, it could be 15, it could be 18. That is a bigger jump. Mm. But I think the depth thing is one issue, but I don't think what it did was contribute to a burnout. I think it skewed them psychologically. They knew that if they don't have Saliba, this next step is a big drop. They probably knew that about Jesus and Nketiah, but they kind of got their way through, and Trossard was a big kind of influence in that. A couple of, you know, Jorginho as well coming in, Partey was missing. I think it's been in the mind. I mean, like, they were always like the upstarts, and they were riding the crest of a wave, and then it gets serious.
Yeah.
It gets serious. And from March 16th, they were out of Europe, that's 2 months ago, and they had nothing else except the Premier League to focus on, which was a stark contrast to Manchester City. And they've won four games out of nine since then. And so, like, I'm not going to say they've bottled it, because it's not, I hate that term, and I know everyone reaches for it, but they've been found wanting when the pressure really arrived, because what was always a possibility and maybe became reality. It's like, we can do this.
Mm.
And that's when they were found wanting. So, like, there's no guarantees. I mean, who knows about next season? I think what they are now is a kind of, as much as anyone can be. We've seen what's happened to Liverpool this year. They're an established force competing for the top four. Beyond that, there's nothing else. There's just City.
I think that all, we know what to expect from Arsenal in a way next season in terms of aspirations. Like, they're going to be in the Champions League. I think people would say they need to get out of the group, obviously. Like, that's the first target there. Obviously, playing against tougher opposition in Europe. The Cups, they didn't feature in this year. Now, if they're a team that's as good as what we've seen in the Premier League, they're going to need to be much stronger in the Cup competitions. And then you'd still say they have to go and challenge for the top four, if not certainly be in it. So we kind of know there's going to be a lot more on their plate next season. So the question is really what they need. I know one of my Arsenal mates messaged me saying we need five players this morning.
Need numbers. They need numbers because they're competing on so many more fronts, and Champions League is a different... Like, they changed the team when it was the Europa League. You don't take it quite seriously until the later stages. Now they will. So that will affect their Premier League form, energy at least. So they need numbers, actually. And, like, clearly they need to improve in certain areas. They need a centre-half who's going to come and be, like, impactful in the starting 11, your best start 11. I think they need another midfielder. It's the same, and be around that. I think they need numbers and depth.
I understand you looking at it mathematically. 12 points is better than last year, but being being at the top of the Premier League until April, maintaining that challenge to City until almost the finish line, that's an overachievement.
It was hugely unexpected, yeah. Okay, I acknowledge that. But when you come to look at the cold hard numbers at the end of the season, we'll see that there's still a gap.
Basically, the reason that you're saying they aren't overachieved, because although they showed us a different level of football, they didn't show us a different character in Arsenal.
How many
people in this country said, don't worry, Arsenal, in the end, when the pressure comes on, they will fail, like they did last year in terms of the hunt for the Champions League. And to be honest, it came true. You can't say it didn't.
Yeah, but
it's not like they lost all the games against big teams or the best teams in the league. They drew matches against teams fighting relegation from two goals up or two goals down at home to the team that was relegated first.
Yeah, but Tom's right. What we saw before then was new. So, like, we have seen a change in character. It's not been enough. Because they're competing against is, like, unprecedented.
Mm.
Like, the City juggernaut, people doubted whether it was going to come. It always comes. Every year after New Year, it comes. And what they're doing has never been seen before in the Premier League.
So in a word, will Arsenal continue to be challengers for the Premier League title after this season? Obviously, there are big ifs, and mainly to do with recruitment in the summer.
Yeah. That wasn't very committed, was it?
Yeah, it was very half-hearted. Right now, yes. Yeah, I'd say yes.
Yeah.
But the transfer window makes a huge difference.
I know. None of us can tell the future, Tom, but I just thought it'd be interesting to see how
it's
you feel about...
predicting these things.
Because I don't feel like they'll challenge for the title next season. And I know a lot of people say, well, we've been brilliant, this, that and the other. But I think there's going to be a lot more on their plate. But I also think what they showed us this year... Like I said, they're going to have to go up, not in terms of quality, but in terms of character. Like, I know there are young players in that squad. If they're going to challenge for the league again, they need to mature quickly. Arteta, by the way, needs to change as well. You know, he didn't change major things in games that weren't going their way. And ultimately, he has to learn from that as well.
He needs a little bit more composure too, I think.
Yeah.
Because I think probably it's reflected in the team. We look at so many, the goals they've conceded recently have been like panicked. They look like frenzied. We're in a state of frenzy, and he's sometimes laid on the touchline. So, look, that obviously, everything he's done has been incredible, and we've seen in the documentary that his methods are inspiring them. But perhaps in the kind of heat of the of the battle, he needs to tone it down a little bit.
Well, his favourite phrase of the season, I mean, all season long and last season as well, was the need to look in the mirror. He says that an awful lot. And if he does that properly, then they might just be in with a chance to have another go at it, because he does strike me as someone who would do it honestly and get a lot of help analysing exactly where they went wrong and using the experience of being so close. That's the key, isn't it? I mean, that's what Klopp was so good at, was using disappointment to fire you on to success. Don't feel drained by the fact you came so close and failed. Use that as the motivation to do it better next time, which sounds easy, but it's really hard to do, because human nature is that you just think, well, for goodness sake, we gave it everything and we didn't win. And then you feel dreadful and you don't expect to grow from it. Arteta, I think, probably has the intelligence to know if they've failed this season but come close and been top of the table for so long. I mean, this is the thing. They have... That's a fact, isn't it? They were top of the table for a long time. They need, if you can take that, if you can bottle that, analyse that to death, then and get the investment over the summer, you really should be able to challenge again, because that's what they didn't have this season, was the ability to know what it felt like to be chased and hunted down. And now they know, they should be able to use that to good effect, I think.
The problem they're going to have next season is that it's going to be a totally different prospect in terms of their seeding for the Champions League. Means they're probably going to have a tough group, and Europe wasn't quite the distraction this year that I think it will be next year.
I've got to say, top teams, big clubs like Arsenal, when they're in the fourth pot, usually they're fine. Just turns out that way. I don't know why. What do you think, Alison, very finally on this, about Arsenal challenging? You're saying yes?
I'm just giving you my answer.
No, but in a word, I'm a very simple man.
Well, challenging is a loose enough term to say yes.
All right, thanks. My personal view is, like I said, I don't think so, but huge caveat, if they get Declan Rice, I think it would be a transformative signing, honestly, in terms of character, in terms of his ability to help stop other teams scoring goals, and he's brilliant. So if the rumours are true and he's number one target and the player they're likely to get and he's happy to go to Arsenal, then I'd say absolutely yes, they will be challenging for the title next season.
I was at Brentford yesterday and he was rested, Declan Rice, but he came off the bench and it was almost comical the impact he had straight away. He started pressing and being quite manic and intense. So all his teammates sort of copied him, and what was a soporific, dreadful performance became, just briefly for about 10 minutes, a positive one, because of his presence on the pitch. And if you doubted the hype around Declan Rice, you just needed to see those 10 minutes to see the effect he has on a whole team. It's like they he's a leader and they do what he does. So he would be, I think he'd slot into a bigger club very easily.
And he's English. 120 million, that's what I say.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, Road Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Right, let's move on. Leeds United. I'm actually going down the league, so this may seem like a jump, but obviously they were playing Newcastle, ended in a draw. And I think Leeds gave themselves a big chance of staying up. Certainly the performance over the last two games, in my mind, against Manchester City, losing by just a goal, and then coming from behind, battling to a point at Elland Road, was another important performance, who knows, just to carry into their final couple of games. Three penalties, a red card in this game. Big Sam has found something. Not a lot, but something, in my opinion. Do you agree, Gregor?
I don't know. I mean, watching the kind of analysis of this, you're seeing, oh, look, they're running, showing loads of energy, pressing. Like, when have Leeds not done that? It's like, it's controlling it that's the important thing. And, like, I don't know. I mean, Martin Hardy wrote in today's Times that playing cock in midfields kind of seemed to give them a little bit more sort of protection. But they've still got defenders who, like, need clown music played over the top of them sometimes. Like, Junior Firpo just fell over. Wober swung at fresh air and then landed on Isak for the penalty. Firpo's, like, I mean, it's a big boost that he's suspended. He's calamitous. defensively.
He had a nightmare. He had an absolute nightmare, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, he can give something going forward, but when you need some semblance of reliability at the back when you're in a relegation battle, he's not someone to have in your team. But the problem is, you can say that about a lot of Leeds defenders. So, but you know, I watched this and thought, yeah, you're seeing energy, you're seeing fight, you're seeing willingness, you're seeing drive. Great, but you're also seeing them find new ways to concede goals.
He needed to give them composure. He hasn't given them that.
I don't think he can. I think he knows that. He said, like, we need to see improvement. Even after the last game, he's like, we need to see another 5% improvement, or else we're in trouble. Like, I don't think he can see that. It's just going to be, like, it's going to come down to, can they score more goals than they let in? I know that sounds really basic, but they are capable of scoring goals, but they're undoubtedly going to throw them in. So, like, they need Patrick Bamford not to miss a penalty. They need him to take a chance when it presents itself, and that's just going to be a moment. So it's really fine margins for Leeds now.
And that was an ugly, the situation with Bamford, where he was abused, and the threats towards his family isn't quite going to put him in the mood for doing that in the final games of the season. And yet, having said that, looking at the teams at the bottom and the fixtures that they've got, I actually think Leeds should be, in theory, best.
Who've they got?
Well, they've got West Ham next, who are safe, and are potentially should as well be concentrating on the Europa Conference League final.
They rested everyone against Brentford. Exactly. They weren't thinking about the league at all.
That's exactly what I mean. You know, what seeing that yesterday, that is a team focused entirely, and a manager focused entirely on winning a trophy. So Leeds, I can see Leeds winning that. And then the final game at home is Tottenham, whose season is unravelling extremely quickly, and it's at home. And I do think Elland Road will make a huge difference. So,
and won't Spurs be trying to avoid the Europa Conference League by that point?
Yes.
I don't think they will, if you listen to Harry Kane, because obviously they're in it. It represents an opportunity to win a trophy, which they haven't done for a while.
So they don't know how to win a trophy. They would have relished, no matter what it's called.
I do think there are so many issues with Leeds United that I don't know. When Pat Bamford stood up to take the penalty, I was like, he's not scoring.
So I said that as
not,
well.
Not in a million Everyone years. Said that. And I was kind of like, do they not get themselves? I get it. Bamford taking that penalty was like, our striker hasn't scored for 15 games and he's a bit down. Let's give him a pen. It wasn't like we're in, you know, mortal risk of being relegated and we need to make sure this hits the back of the net, because you, in that situation, he's not the guy right now. I'm not even going to say he's a bad player. Like, he's just not in the mindset right now to be taking pressure penalties like that. And I know people
say, who do you think decided he would take the penalty then?
Well, is he the penalty taker? If he's the
they've got a new manager who's come in to make, you know, marginal gains. Mm. And one of those marginal gains is you get a penalty, you've worked out who's going to take it and look at what's happened in the past. And Allardyce said of Robert Koch, you know, he's got all the football now. He's made him sound like the main man. Surely you make him just whack it in, you know.
Well, he might be doing the same to Bamford, you know, saying, I'm putting my trust and faith in you. That includes taking the penalties. It's maybe a mistake. Also recognise when I'm watching this that Carl Robinson had him at MK Dons. There's like, when he went out on loan from Chelsea, I think what they will be trying to do is give him as much confidence as they can possibly can, because they need him. They need him to score some goals. Like, there's no one else.
But that's what I mean. It struck me as, we need to give the striker some confidence, give him the ball. I'm like, not now, guys. This is not the... They score that penalty. They go 2-0 up. And I think they win that game. And I immediately thought Harrison was going to take it. Jack Harrison was going to take it. I just thought, for mentality, for confidence in their team at the moment, he's kind of right up there. And I'd be really confident that he was going to score it. And, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing. But I just couldn't believe Bamford was taking it. And when he missed, no one was shocked. I don't know if anyone in the stadium, outside the stadium, watching on TV, whatever it might be, was surprised that Bamford didn't score. It's just not going for him at the moment. So I thought that was a poor decision and didn't really read the room in terms of the situation that they're in at the moment. But coming from behind to equalise, showing a little bit of something against a good Newcastle side, I thought was hugely positive for Leeds.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Gregor was right in terms of the... what Allardyce has to do in these final days before the end of the season is sort out that defence, because I think if you can do that, if you can get them structured, then I think they have enough quality at the top end of the pitch to get through and to survive. But and just sticking on Bamford, I think that was his fourth penalty miss for Leeds.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it just backs up your point, Hugh, that it wasn't the right decision. It wasn't the right time for him to take it.
Had he been banging in goals every week, I wouldn't have minded it. I would have said confident player, you know, really happy in front of goal. As you pointed out a little bit earlier on, he's not enjoying his time in football generally at the moment. And I just didn't see that it was the right decision. He's found it hard. He's missed some big chances. You got to give it to a player who's, I think, in a different mindset than Bamford is at the moment. But there you go. I do want to look ahead to Thursday very quickly, because it's a massive game, Newcastle against Brighton. Newcastle obviously will be pretty gutted to not win against Leeds United, but I still think it's, what, 8 wins out of the last 10. They're at home against Brighton on Thursday night. But if you look at the table, there's a decent gap between them, really. It's more about Brighton's chances of getting into the Europa League. This is their game in hand. Newcastle United on 66 points, they're third. Brighton down in sixth at the moment, 58 points, so decent gap, 8 points. But this, as I say, the game in hand. So what do we think? I'm going to this game, and I'm
lucky you. It's
absolutely
going to be a cracker,
delighted.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be a brilliant game, I think. And it's very hard to gauge where it goes.
Newcastle don't lose, then they're okay, I think. Because you've got to look from Newcastle's point as well.
Yeah.
I mean, if they do lose, then it's squeaky bum time.
Depends what happens tonight for Leicester and Liverpool. Obviously, if Liverpool win that match, then yeah, big pressure on.
Pressure on, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big game for both, obviously. And quite, you know, it'd be an intriguing one as well, because the way Newcastle's biggest strength has been like their energy at the top of the pitch, in terms of like the way they press and you know, all go together in little clusters. And Brighton are, but they're not daft. They know that the way that Brighton play, so they might have to slightly alter their approach. So that'll be an intriguing tactical battle as well.
I think part of the reason we're all saying it's going to be such a good game is because they are the two, in a way, they're the two teams of the season. The two unexpected teams of the season.
Unexpected, exciting. I think so. I agree with you, Tom.
You can't call a sports washing project a great thing of the season.
No, I'm talking about the way they play. I'm not. I don't mean Brighton are the team of the season.
Yes,
I mean
okay,
the way
good.
They play.
Yes, by quite a distance.
Yeah, yeah.
Over
that's
Newcastle.
Why I don't want to get too excited about Man City either.
All right, it should be a great game. Some of us looking forward to it more than others, clearly. But let's move on a little bit further down the table to another team trying to get into Europe, a bit like Brighton. See what I've done with the kind of order today. Aston Villa, eighth at the moment. They beat Tottenham 2-1, sixth consecutive home league win. Moves them level on points with Spurs. Spurs seventh, 57 points in the table. Villa were 19th. After losing 4 of their first 5 Premier League games this season. With 2 matches left, they're away at Liverpool, then at home to Brighton. Another Brighton tough game, like I mentioned. They do have the chance of qualifying for Europe for the first time since the 2010-11 season. I look at the table and I keep thinking, is it realistic? Isn't it for Villa? I just can't tell at the moment. Are they playing well enough, in your opinion, to be getting into the Europa League conversation? Are we talking about a Europa Conference League team here? Will they have enough?
Well, they just this is yet another manager who's come in, so he's had to hit the ground running, and you sort of feel if you'd been there the whole season, then you'd be saying, yeah, they absolutely should be in Europe, because when you analyse Villa, you're forgetting that the season started badly, and so it's been a lot of catch up, and it's almost as if they've had the odd blip, but of late. But Emery overall is another manager who ought to win an accolade at the end of the season for how he's transformed a team with very little changing other than him and his approach to the team and getting that extra 10% out of every single individual. So it does seem slightly unfair that because they've had the occasional blip since he's taken over, they probably won't have enough to... They might make the Conference League, I suppose. But they do strike me, because of what we know about Emery, that they are a team that ought to be in the Europa League, which is what he's very good at. And they, you know, if they were in it, you'd think, oh, I'd put money on them winning it. So it's just that he's had to play catch-up.
I'm not sure they will, in the end, make the Europa League. But if they did, it says a lot, the fact we're even talking about it. And if they did, he would be another manager who should be considered for manager of the season, which again, the list is quite incredible, because you think of the job that he's done, you think of the job that Roberto De Zerbi's done. Another one I thought recently is Gary O'Neill for the job he's... They've all come in midway
through
the season.
And you haven't even mentioned my manager of the year.
Which was...
Thomas Frank.
Yeah, exactly. But I just meant the three that had come in midway through the season. But how have... I don't remember a season where so many coaches could be the manager of the year. And that might be partly to do with the fact that the teams who have... That the big teams who have dropped off have allowed other teams to achieve...
Fill the void, far, yeah.
But it's also in stark contrast to the cast of several who shouldn't be in Premier League dugouts. I keep saying it every week, like Frank Lampard, Dean Smith... Mm. Ryan Mason.
Sorry.
Stellini.
Listeners couldn't see Gregor's expression.
Gregor was angry when he said the words Ryan Mason.
I mean, I don't want to be unkind, but like, just that he was even like considering saying that I want the job. Like, yeah. I can't believe the delusion that some people can have. Like, what?
But Christian Stellini being in there would have been...
Exactly.
Just
it's the
as
same.
Bad.
It's the same.
Yeah.
And yeah, anyway, there have been a lot of really, really bad and sort of baffling Premier League managerial jobs or appointments, and then, you know, contrast it with, as Tom says, some brilliant ones.
I do think the number of managers who've done it, it's not just overperforming in terms of the table, you know, the tactical nous, the style of football that most of the managers that you mentioned, the style of football, even Bournemouth, you know, and the different tactical ploys that the teams use to create advantages, whatever that it might be for their unique players. It's been brilliant to see. You know, it doesn't matter which team you pick out, there are some fantastic coaches on show.
And bringing it back to Villa, the same is true of them. I mean, the way he's got the most from Ollie Watkins, the way that, look, in this game they played with such a high line, that, like, I don't know how Spurs didn't do something with it, but because they did it so well. But then there's been other games where they've played almost, if they've taken the lead, they've played almost like a back six, and then three banks of two in front of it. So it's flexible as well. But the main thing, again, underlining it all, is like the energy and the way they hunt in packs. And when they go forward, it's taking a direct line of sight to goal.
Very quickly on Tottenham Hotspur, because even though we're talking about them possibly fighting for the Conference League, Europa League, whatever it might be, they are officially out of the running for the Champions League. And this is going to be the third time in four seasons that Tottenham don't make the top four, which for me, I think if they're a different club, maybe you batter them if they're Manchester United or someone like that. But for me, and I mean this with all due respect, like, this is Tottenham. And they are, you could spin that stat as saying, like, well, they've obviously been subpar. But actually, I think if you reach the top four in your Spurs, I do think that's a good season. I think that's a great season, you know, because the years when Pochettino was there and the couple of years where they flirted with the title, finished second, finished third, you know, again, football expectation changes so quickly, and suddenly we were like, oh, they've got Harry Kane, they've got Son, like, they don't have any of the other elements to be really in the Champions League, and they didn't really have the elements to be challenging for the title before. They didn't have enough, and that's why they didn't win the league. They had a great coach, they had a great style of football, they had a fantastic defence. They didn't win the league because 1-11 wasn't good enough. They got to a Champions League final, they didn't win that because 1-11 wasn't good enough. That team has not improved. The coach clearly is not good enough at the moment. So many issues have been going on. So I don't want to hammer them for being out of the Champions League once again, because I don't think they're, you know, a bit like saying Arsenal weren't really in the mode to win the Premier League. I don't think Spurs are in the mode to finish top four this year. And I get it. You look at the number of wins they've had. I think they've had 17 wins, and you're kind of still like, they could have done better. I mean, they didn't play that well. They won 17 games. But I think there have been big issues there throughout the season. The question is really, with them missing out on the Champions League, where does it leave the club? What is reasonable expectation? The latest news on the manager is Julian Nagelsmann out of the running completely. I think we're into the sixth week of a search for a new manager at Spurs. You know, where is the club? Where is the club right now? What do they need to do next?
When they built the stadium, which was very expensive, they said, the club actually said, this is a stadium built for Champions League football, and it's embarrassing if there's anything else being played there. I mean,
I almost think that not making the Champions League is the least important thing for them just now. Like, they need to get a structure in place. Like, they've lost a manager, an interim manager, the sporting director. The atmosphere is, you know, borderline toxic at the club. Like, you can put the season to bed, but what they need to do is now get a structure and a head coach and, you know, the fundamentals of a successful football club in the football department. They have all off the field. They need those things in place for next season. I don't think it matters whether they're in the Champions League or not, because they even found the season when they were in the Champions League, it was dispiriting. They didn't, like, there's more, they realised that there was more to supporting your team than watching them playing really conservative football against better teams than them in Europe.
Yeah. The manager is the biggest decision they'll make this summer, because the chaos is in the fact they currently don't have a sporting director to hire one. But at the same time,
Daniel Levy can do it. That's like Tom Burley this.
But also, you laugh about it, but he did before.
Exactly,
he did. He brought in Fabio Paratici. He didn't do a great deal for that club at all. Before Daniel Levy was running it, he brought in Mauricio Pochettino. He led things, and it was going extremely well during that period. There's no reason why they desperately need one now to sort them out. I agree on the structure, but I think at a club like Tottenham, with the way it was before, it needs a manager to sort it out. I think of Roberto De Zerbi, but I think Alisson's right. I don't think he gets on at all well with Daniel Levy. But if they get the right, that is the key cog. So long as they sort that out, then
history has proved that doesn't happen.
One at a time, children. One at a time. Alisson, Gregor, someone.
I'm just saying, like, we look at, there's a brief spell where you thought Paratici might work when Romero was playing well and Kulusevski was playing well. Yeah. But over a long period of time now, the recruitment has been a disaster. And so it's not just about the manager coming in, because he's not going to do that. It's not the way modern football works. It's about, like, every successful club has a... But why are Brighton so successful now? Because they have people in key positions, and when someone moves on, they know who's going to step up. Spurs don't have anyone in the key positions, and they don't know who to fill them with. Like, that's the fundamental issue for Tottenham. And that will help them hire the right head coach. It will help them have the right kind of... As Alisson wrote about a few weeks ago, start to make the kind of... change the culture of the place. That's what Spurs need to do. Put the season out of their mind and focus on that.
But what manager has the force of personality to change the culture? They've had two of the biggest egos in world football.
It's not on the manager to do it. Haven't been able
to navigate the oddity that is Spurs.
Yeah, it's not on the manager to do it. That's my point. It's on Daniel Levy. And if you,
yeah,
and
but you're, that, you're, then you're asking physician heal thyself. He's not going to have the self-awareness to know that he needs to stop the rot, because part of the rot is him.
Well, they're in trouble then.
Yes.
Well, I think he needs to revert back to his best appointment was Mauricio Pochettino, wasn't it?
And I think there's too much water going under the bridge. I don't mean to get him back. I just mean to revert back to Daniel Levy running the club in the way he used to run it. I think Spurs have taken another step and their ambitions are higher now.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is that their ambitions are definitely higher, but they're just going about it in the wrong way, because when he brought in Pochettino, they were a Champions League side then, weren't they, when Pochettino came in? But he brought someone who was progressive, who was going to grow with them. And then when Pochettino went, it was hiring people who had done, who had achieved things, won trophies that they wanted to do.
Well, that is a good point though. They need somebody who wants to go on a journey with them, not who's almost feels like they're doing a favour joining.
If Graham Potter hadn't have gone to Chelsea this summer, he would be the perfect appointment.
I'd still say they should get Potter, in my opinion. I don't see any reason why not just go back and get him. But I think they're waiting for basically, you know, all the other cards to fall into the place with bigger clubs than them to see who's left and see if they can get. I genuinely think, because what are they waiting for? Why is it taking 6 weeks? Look how many great managers were out of a job. So if they haven't appointed someone in 6 weeks, they must be waiting to see where all the others are going to end up and see who. Because no one wants to be this, like, no one wants the money, no? Oh, all right. Well, someone will do it eventually, I guess. Another club who's in need of a new manager. We're getting closer. Almost there, right, Tom Roddy? Chelsea, Mauricio Pochettino, just about done. Is that right?
Yeah, well, just needs the signature, essentially. it's all agreed. I think it's the right outcome from the beginning, because I think he really fits what they need, and I think it's going to be a different situation to what Graham Potter inherited. I think he will have a lot more control than Graham Potter did, and he's been quite smart in a way, because you don't come into this team for the final games of the season, because that could have easily happened. You let Frank Lampard take that hit, and that's a big hit, and take over in the summer. But he's got a huge task ahead of him this summer, because you've got to find a striker that's going to work for you, which could be Romelu Lukaku coming back from Inter Milan. I don't see why, given the type of manager Mauricio Pochettino is, I think that could work with Lukaku. I think he could get him going. I'm not convinced right now that Lukaku is interested in coming back to Chelsea. I think that relationship has been soured, or that memory has been soured so much that I don't think he'd want to. But you've got Mason Mount's future. You've got to build the team around a player like Enzo Fernandez, who's most expensive player in British history. But developing young players is what Pochettino is best known for. So that's the big thing for him to focus on this summer, is working out who sticks around, because the big problem has been that the size of that squad is so bloated, and trimming that, working out who sticks around, and the benefit that he has is it can't get any worse, surely. It can't get any worse. And Chelsea should always be in the Champions League. And that would be, if they did manage to get top four next season, I think it would be seen as a huge success.
Yeah. Oh yeah, having all those free nights with no European football in them. I mean, you can do all sorts of parties, you can Lots of bonding trips
going on, yes, with Mauricio Pochettino and his squad next year. Needs to trim it significantly, has to be said. 3-year deal, we expect him to sign. He will take charge at the end of the season, that's right. So Frank Lampard will still be in charge for the rest of the campaign, which will be painful to the ears of Chelsea fans after the weekend. Nottingham Forest getting a 2-2 draw, it's weird, isn't it? You look through Forest fixtures and their terrible away form, and everyone went, they'll probably get something at Chelsea, though.
Yep.
That's how bad Chelsea have been so far this season. And it turned out to be the case. Taiwo Awoniyi scoring twice as well, ending a run of 7 straight league away defeats for Steve Cooper's side. 3 points above third bottom Leeds United with 2 games remaining. So incredibly tight, but a 3-point buffer. Actually, it feels like a big margin at this point in time, because you can't see Leeds winning a game. It'd have to be something special, but there you go. Forest have taken 7 points from their last 4 games, within touching distance of staying up, if you like. How big a point was it for your old side, Gregor?
Huge. But I mean, I wouldn't be too quick about that because their goal difference is worse than Leeds. So it could come down to goal difference. But it was massive, yeah. And it, also, Awoniyi's finding his goal scoring boots finally is massive. Like, they look like they have a focal point when they put the ball in the box. In this game and away at Liverpool, when I was at that game, eyebrows were raised when they left out Brennan Johnson as one of the best players, but they've kind of just gone away from home, a bit more solidity in the middle of the park and a focal point up front, and he's been really good actually. So yeah, huge, but it's still on a knife edge. It's still absolutely possible that they go down.
He was brilliant actually, and he would probably be the reason that they stay up, because it's not just, it wasn't just the goals, it was his hold up play, it was everything.
It was the same against Liverpool. He bullied Konate. Bullied him,
yeah.
And you know, that's a huge kind of bonus when you're playing away from home. You can throw the ball up to him and it sticks, and then get someone like Ibs White in support.
And I think there's an irony that he was the first signing of the 72 or however they brought in this season, and could end up coming good right at the very end and keeping them alive. That it's one of those bizarre situations at the end of the season where you would think Arsenal, Nottingham Forest is an easy win for Arsenal, but with the title already gone for them now, that is a bit massive chance for Forest. If their motivation is entirely gone, but
Palace away,
away on the last game of the season, yeah. It doesn't feel.
I'm not sure about them, totally
confident yet.
I'm hoping Palace are on the beach already, booking their flights at this
just
point.
Just front
in
three
time.
Don't look like they are. No. Although Zaha's pulled his hammy, I think, isn't he?
But they still look bloody good going forward, haven't they?
Yeah. But it is weird that, to me, Forest. I've only just started to look like a proper team rather than a collection.
They had a good run in the middle of the
season. I know they did. To me, this is the point at which they've started to look like they're a team. They look like they understand each other. There are little triangles. There's understanding. There's camaraderie. They look like a team as opposed to Steve Cooper having to pretend they are.
It's like twice in the season after the mad influx of players. The time that he's had on the training ground, it started to bear fruit, and you see, as Alison says, you do see relationships, and you see them settle upon a shape that offers them a bit more protection defensively and gives them a threat on the counter. And then in January, another influx of players came, kind of looked like it upset the apple cart. There were some injuries, and then that's why it's so touch and go. I think if it hadn't been for that and had a bit more rub of the green with injuries, they could have been safe by now.
I've really enjoyed Frank Lampard turning into one of his memes over the course of his time in charge, because he was basically all positive at the start with a smile on his face saying we just need to get back to a bit of confidence. Last week it was unacceptable for a Chelsea shirt. Now he started to blame the players a little bit as well. The no but seriously moment has come in, and yes, seriously, Chelsea just aren't that good, to be honest. But I loved it where he just came out this weekend and was basically like, you know, the players need to take a look at themselves. I was like, oh, Frank's shifting the blame now, is he? He's got reputation protection needs to come in at some point in time. He's reached that point. So that was, an interesting side note from the game. But finally on the podcast, I've left it late, obviously, because I think we felt it was coming for some time. But we need to talk about Southampton. Their 11-year stay in the Premier League ended in pretty tame fashion, relegated with a defeat at home by Fulham. The Prime Minister was there. Rishi Sunak was there, watching over their demise as sport imitated life in many ways. Anyway, Southampton collecting just 3 points from the last 33 available. And basically, that was it. Much of the damage done long before that run as well. Southampton slipped into the relegation zone on the 6th of November after a 4-1 defeat to Newcastle, and they have stayed in the bottom three ever since. You remember earlier on in the season, they sacked Ralf Hasenhüttl a day after that defeat, subsequently appointed Nathan Jones, which we all know didn't go very, very well, and then put Ruben Selles, one of the coaching team, in charge for the rest of the season. My first question on Southampton, a bit like Arsenal, overarching, what do we feel has cost Southampton through the course of this season?
Oh my goodness, just terrible, terrible, terrible takeover. The new owners made it clear very quickly, like off the record to everybody that they didn't like Ralph. And so Hasenhüttl was in the job too long, knowing they didn't really want him there. And it was mainly player power. A few he fell out with a few players. And what often happens with owners is they want to be on the, you know, they want to get on with the players more. And so you had this strange, I mean, it was very peculiar for everyone in the world to know that Hasenhüttl would get the sack eventually. That's not how you run an organisation. You get rid of him straight away or you give him proper backing. So there was this sort of twilight zone that didn't do them any good. And then, but if you look at his Hasenhüttl's points tally compared to the people that came in after him, he was twice as good. Mm. So they got rid of someone who was adequate to keep them in the Premier League for two managers who had no experience whatsoever of the Premier League, and their points tallies were well, so poor that the relegation became inevitable. So it's poor knowledge from above. It's poor insight. It's not being able. It's believing that you're a puppeteer and you can organise a club better than it has been. And maybe you need that sense of arrogance if you go in to a new organisation. But I just, it's there are lots and lots and lots of small reasons, but the biggest reason was that they got rid of the manager that would have kept them in the division.
There was a, I agree with Alison, but there was a theory for a long time with Hasenhüttl that it was running out, it was running its course with him. So it wasn't, I don't think it was a huge surprise at the time when he went.
The surprise is that he didn't go earlier.
Yeah.
That's my point. You either get rid of him straight away, because it was just badly done.
Mm. But I think another key reason to why they've gone down is the investment in players. I just don't think they brought players with a lot of potential, like Romeo Lavia, who's fantastic talent and will be
a former Southampton player in a few weeks.
Yeah, yes, will be snapped up and will probably be, has the potential to be an elite player and play for one of those top six clubs. Yeah. You've seen it in moments this
probably
season.
Probably see him at Stamford Bridge soon.
yes. But they've just bought too young, they bought too inexperienced, and you can't do that when you're in that position at the table. And the thing as well is, Martin Samuel wrote about it a few weeks ago, that Southampton are a little bit of a warning to teams like Brighton in selling off too many players, going too far with it, and you run out of that recruitment.
They believed in magic in the end at Southampton, because there was a period when they were the model. Like, people were gushing about them the way we've been gushing about Brighton for slightly different reasons. They never hit the heights in terms of entertainment. But they were so well. They had this. They were the first club in the Premier League to have analysis so that they would know in advance we're going to need a new left back, say. But they'd go through all the people who could players that could possibly fit that role in the club, right down to the youth level. And if they figured it was going to take too long for one of those to be groomed for the role when they felt they were going to lose their left back, then they would apply the statistics to good value across Europe and the rest of the world. So they were that's what most clubs do now, but they were the first to do it to, as a model that would make them money and mean they were never, like people would say, oh, you know, are you a bit worried about that player being injured? No, because we've got it all sorted out. And that's what teams like Brentford and Brighton do, is they plan for.
But this is an age ago.
People to, yes, exactly. But they believed in it as being a magic thing, and never realised. Well, the world's caught up with you now. That isn't going to be enough.
I don't agree.
They lost
that.
The key staff. They lost the key backroom staff. The top guy went to Spurs, I think, because Pochettino took him. They just sort of figured they'd had it, so it would carry on. You need to keep on top of those sorts of analysis to make it count, and they didn't. It sort of became a cobwebby state of affairs as opposed to state of the art.
Clearly, they kind of they were in a state of decline before the takeover, but the takeover is the thing that means they're, why they're relegated. They're under new ownership now. It's like, you can talk about clubs, you know, the reality of the Premier League catching up with the clubs, but you can only do that if it's like, you're talking about Leicester because they're owned by the same people who, under whom they won the Premier League. Mm-hmm. Like, they have new owners now, and one of them is, you know, Rasmus Ankersen, mm-hmm. who like, has written books about how to crack the secrets of high performance. I was reading a piece the other day where he's saying, like, there's a theory where, because he was a co-director with Phil Giles at Brentford, he'd rein him in. There's no one to rein him in, I don't think, here. Mm. It's like, he sees his way of running a football club, and it's heavily data influenced. That's why we saw them sign a bunch of kids and no one with experience. Like, even at Brentford, it took a while before they signed Pontus Janssen.
Yeah.
We were always saying they need to add something else here. And like, I doubt that would have come from Rasmus Ankersen.
Yeah.
So he has ideas about how to shake up the system and do things differently. And it's backfired. It's like borderline and arrogance.
9 summer signings without a single Premier League appearance, and they added 5 more players who'd never played in the Premier League in January. I got to say, Sport Republic's an apt name. They've guaranteed their independence from Premier League royalty.
I like
what they did there. on that. Tenuous.
But we all sound like we're being argumentative with each other. It's all been a fact. Everything we've said is a factor. It's not one thing.
For me,
the takeover, it was at the wrong time for the club with the wrong people. Yeah.
The major factor, though, for me is that they could have approached recruitment in a different way. You know, the stats are one thing. Character, personality is another thing. Experience is a big thing, particularly if you're going to be in a relegation battle, because ultimately they were still going to be in the bottom 5 or 6 teams. So where was the experience? You know, it was just madness. We said it at the start of the season. They're either going to be like the story of the season, or they're definitely getting relegated.
Well, it was inexperience leading inexperience in the end, wasn't
it? Yeah. The question is, finally, can Southampton bounce back?
Of course they can. You have to be really stupid not to be in the reckoning in the Championship when you've got a £42 million parachute payment and the average turnover's like...
So there's a good chance that they went then. Based on everything that we've just said about inexperience, leading experience, etc.
Come on, Watford, and they were still in with a shout until half a dozen games to go in the season and their fourth manager or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, no, I think they'll be... They'll have a good chance because they'll be able to keep a hold of some of the young players because
they've got no
experience. Won't be earning huge money. Yeah, they'll be probably not have suitors, you know, willing to pay the same money that they paid for them. So keeping some of them and hopefully having announced to add a few people who've played in the Championship before.
The team needs a big change though, doesn't it? Because it's gonna they've been so reliant on Ward-Prowse this year, and they're gonna lose him, aren't they? So the team needs a change.
Well, it'll have to be, because there's other people like Bela Kotchup, who's a Germany international.
Walker Peters, will he stay?
Be a little big turnover, I would imagine.
Who would you get as manager?
Nathan Jones.
I was thinking about this morning, and I know Scott Parker went off to Belgium, but I was kind of like, because I looked up in advance of the podcast, I was like, okay, let's see what the rumours are about who might take over at Southampton. And every article I read, I was like, they're not taking the Southampton job. So Steven Gerrard's not going to go to Southampton. You know, some of the other names that were mentioned were just... Rafa Benitez, he's not going to go to Southampton. You know, like, I was reading all these articles, and at the end of it, I didn't find one manager plausible. But then I thought, why hasn't Scott Parker been mentioned in all of that? Now, people will know his personality more, and there'll be conversations in football about what he needs as a manager, and maybe he wants more than what Southampton can offer, because he would want, I imagine, a team that's got a very good chance of going straight up, given what he's done with his previous clubs. But for me, I'd be looking at someone like that.
I think we could be surprised, though. I mean, we were surprised by Nathan Jones.
Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. What? I was being serious.
It could be someone we least expect, because that's what Rasmus Ankersen does.
Maybe he will be the man.
You asked the question, Tom. I thought you might.
No, I don't. It's because I'm so puzzled as to who it could be. I don't think. I think part of the reason I don't think Scott Parker sees himself as a Championship manager anymore. So I don't think that'll happen. I think that's the reason why his name isn't in the reckoning for it, because he's been there, done that. yeah. type thing.
And, I saw, and tasted the Champions
League. And I saw kind of the more a more reasonable one being Chris Wilder. But again, yeah, exactly. With a group of players that have come out of Man City's academy, you know, I just don't see how it fits with what he would want to do in the EFL.
He doesn't like dealing with the director of football, never mind Sport Republic.
Yeah.
We're buying all the players and providing him with lots of kids. So no chance.
It's going to be interesting because watching the EFL throughout the season and watching some of the exciting players that Southampton do have, you know, some of them will cope well in the Championship and actually be quite an exciting team with the right coach if they can play a certain style of football. We saw Burnley kind of almost against the odds, breaking records almost in terms of the points total. So, you know, you might see something similar if the recruitment goes well and in the Championship level, what they did with the recruitment last summer, you know, they might look like geniuses by the end of next year.
I know the Southampton fans won't want to hear this just now, but I wouldn't write this group off either. Like,
no, I just personally don't think a lot of them will be there. That's
no,
my
I'm
point.
Talking
so
about
I'm not
the
saying
owners.
They're bad players. Oh, I see. Sorry.
Like we've been lambasting them here, but if you look down the list of players, there's a lot of good ones. And like...
But they didn't read the situation.
They didn't read the situation. Hopefully have learned
it's not that they signed bad players, but they, like I said, did they not realise that they were still going to be a bottom six club? And so you need a little bit more strength to your spine than players who've, yeah. you know, when I say no Premier League experience, half of the players that I'm talking about had no senior football experience.
Yeah.
You can't do that if you're going to be in a relegation battle. So Southampton are down, and I will see you on the EFL highlights next season, Southampton fans. It will be enjoyable, believe me. You're going to have a great season, but commiserations for now. Thank you all for joining me. I've enjoyed it. Alison Rudd, Tom Roddy, Gregor Robertson, all of you for listening as well. It's Monday, so pick up a paper, check out the game, all the best from the weekend. Another big game to come this evening in the Premier League between Liverpool and Leicester. If it goes to plan, we won't be talking about it on Thursday. If Leicester win, it's going to be top billing. That's all I'm going to say. Come on, Leicester. Come on, Leicester. Anyway, listen, check out the game online if you want to subscribe to it. It's thetimes.co.uk/the game. Check out the Times app as well, and we'll see you on Thursday. Take care.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.